On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, we discuss the latest news, provide an update on the pending ASC quality reporting deadline and OAS caps, we'll review the new DEA verification process, discuss a recent immediate jeopardy that was called on a listener for humidity out of range, and in our focus segment, discuss cybersecurity and the impact of the recent Change Healthcare incident with Paul Alcock with SIS.
This episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is sponsored by Surgical Information Systems, SIS. SIS's mission is to deliver solutions and services that help surgery providers, regardless of care setting, improve their organization so they can deliver the highest level of care to their patients. For more information, go to sisfirst.com.
Welcome to episode 217 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for April 16th, 2024. Recording from our studios in Spencerport, New York, this is Sue Cronkite, co-host of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey and Operations Manager for Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. We'd like to remind our listeners that the ASC regulatory environment is a rapidly evolving landscape, and the material presented in this episode is based on the most current information available as of the date of recording. As such, it is important to recognize that this information may be subject to change, and we advise all ASCs to stay up to date with the latest regulations and guidelines issued by their relevant regulatory bodies. And joining me today is John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the most respected experts in the ambulatory surgery industry. With over 30 years of experience, Mr. Gailey has authored over 10 books on the ASC industry, and he is a sought-after speaker on regulatory, accreditation, and finance issues. So we have a lot of information we packed into this episode.
Yeah, definitely. As we're putting it all together, we just saw a whole, you know, sometimes, Sue, when you pull together the news, we barely find anything. And then this time around, we have a lot going on, as well as some incidents that I think are very important to talk about. But most importantly, right now, I'm recording this at, 12:30 on Tuesday, April 16th. I'm going to be heading from here right to the airport to catch a flight down to Orlando for ASCA 2024. Very excited. I also found out, Sue, that most of my team is already heading down there. I don't know. You're the one that schedules me. I don't know why you made me come in late, but I'll be down there later tonight, and hopefully I'll post this episode when I get down there. We are going to be doing what we've been doing for as long as the podcast has been around. We're going to have some live episodes. Live meaning that we record them live there with the staff from Amateur Healthcare Strategies, the staff from the ASC Podcast, and anybody else that's down there. We have a lot of loyal listeners that that tend to tag around. So if you are going down to ASCA 2024 and listening to me before the actual event, send an email to info@ascpodcast.com and let us know you're there with your telephone number, and we'll text you information as to where we're meeting up if you'd like to be on the podcast or even just sit back and listen to us talk about the event. It's always an exciting thing. We always have so much enthusiasm when we're putting together those live episodes. And Stu, you're staying behind. You're going to be manning the studio here and taking care of editing everything when I send you up the files to broadcast.
Yep, going to try to get those episodes out pretty quickly. So yep, you'll let me know when you have recordings. And also, there's a few of us holding down the fort for AHS. So.
Yeah, so if you're a client of AHS, don't worry. We have people that are here to take care of you. Hopefully nothing serious happens during ASCA 2024. We also just announced our next boot camps. Remember, our ASC Director of Nursing and ASC Administrator boot camp are the industry-leading leadership training, and they've been around for about 3 years now, since 2021, and we have over 250 graduates, and it is required training for anybody that is a client of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, so you get the same training that all of our clients get if you were to sign up for it. So the Director of Nursing and Nursing Leader Boot camp is May 28th through 31st, 2024. And the administrator's boot camp is going to be July 16th through the 19th, 2024. I should mention, I forgot to mention, these are virtual conferences, so you don't have to go anywhere. Yeah. And they're available online during those days. But there's much more to the boot camp than just the virtual four-day conference. We have weekly drop-in sessions that are optional, as well as access to a number of other educational programs that that we make available to our patron members. Mm-hmm. We also are aware that there are some challenges right now with HHHC. We're going to talk a little bit about that. HHHC is changing its computer system, and they're doing a bang-up job of trying to get the system up and running perfectly, but we thought we would mention some of those things going on, and I will be talking to them while I'm at ASCA. Then we're also going to talk a little bit about a humidity issue that we that one of our listeners called us about, where they were actually issued an immediate jeopardy. And Sue, this is one of those areas that we've been warning people for a long time that you really got to take that seriously. And then lastly, today we're going to talk about the cyber attack again. I know we've kind of mentioned it in the past with Change Healthcare. And during our focus segment, Paul Alcock is going to talk about how you can mitigate or, you know, reduce the chance that's going to happen. And Sue, you're going to talk about in the news the CMS's response to it and how they're helping organizations. But Sue, you also read that.
Yeah, it's kind of continuing. So the people who did the cyber attack are now saying that they're publishing patient information and I think some type of contract information also. So that's all continuing. And then there's all the news about a second attack taking place and there are these kind of dueling ransomware people and it's just
yeah, there's more than one
accelerating.
Organization.
Yeah, and by the time you pay, I think,
right,
then more people come after you. But then if you don't pay, you can't conduct your business. So it's really getting pretty scary.
I know we've been talking about cyber attacks quite a bit, and I know that we've been having speakers talk about it with our interviews, but I just can't emphasize enough, especially when we look around and we talk to our listeners and when we talk to our clients even, we find out that this is not an unusual situation. So so definitely pay attention. Sue, in the meantime, why don't you talk about some of the news?
So from AORN's Outpatient Magazine from March, they had an article about OAS caps talking about when you're looking at vendors. So we'll put a link in our show notes about this, but I just wanted to mention a couple of their tips. They said, aside from the cost factor, which of course is very important, you want to find out how many centers the particular vendor is working with, whether you'll be able to get useful benchmarking data from them, what type of data will they be able to provide you with. And remember, once you choose a vendor, there's still implementation processes that are going to take you a fair amount of time. So as we mentioned before, make sure you're really getting started on that. And I also found a graphic on the oascaps.org website that showed in a pretty simple way the steps to begin your participation with OAS caps. So we'll include that link. And it just gives an overview, and then it has links in each step to take you where you have to go to do that part of your implementation process.
So it's really a step-by-step process there. And we should mention that in episode 216, our last episode, we did do a deep dive into OAS caps. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't listen to that, you might want to listen to that before you go to these links that Sue just provided you information on. And we also want to remind you that the Medicare Quality Reporting Program, better known as ASCQR, is coming up. The deadline is May 15th to file all that information. And, we know that the OAS caps will be a requirement in 2025, but there are quite a number of items that have to be reported before May 15th to the Medicare Quality Reporting Program. Sue, why don't you give a list of those things that they should be looking up? And we will provide a link in the show notes to some more information about that.
There are several things. There's ASC1, which is patient burn, ASC2, patient fall, ASC3, which is wrong site, wrong side, wrong patient, wrong procedure, wrong implant, ASC4, which is all-cause hospital transfer admission, ASC9, endoscopy, polyp, surveillance, appropriate follow-up interval for normal colonoscopy on average-risk patients, ASC13, which is normothermia outcome, ASC14, unplanned anterior vitrectomy, and ASC20, which is COVID-19 vaccination coverage among healthcare personnel. And I believe even if it doesn't apply to you, do you have to go in and either say not applicable or
that's
zero?
That's correct. You have to zero
like
incidents. Yeah. So even if you're not an eye center, you still have to report ASC 14 and indicate that there were no unplanned anterior vitrectomies. And one of the regulatory specialists over at Ambitur Healthcare Strategies, Jenna Alvarez, she kind of noted that the DEA verification process during credentialing and recredentialing has changed. So per letter from 2/21/24, to conduct verifications, ASC should now be requesting access to the registrant dataset access system. We're going to provide a link to that. So those of you that went to the DEA diversion website in the past, you did not have to sign up for it. You would just provide information, which in itself was not easy. But now there's actually a sign-up process and a login process.
And here's the instructions that were found when one of our clients went into that. They say to submit an email with the following information, and they give the email address for that. You have to put in the request itself, your name and title, your phone number, your email address, company information, and why you need the access.
So again, anytime that you're doing verification of a physician's or a provider's DEA number and currency of their license, you are now going to have to do a different process in order to make sure that you comply with the credentialing requirements there. And we also saw an interesting op-ed article in the New Jersey Spotlight News published by LeapFrog. LeapFrog, you might remember, we've talked about them in the past. They're an organization that has been doing surveys to surgery centers. We, in the past, have recommended to not participate in this survey. I do reiterate that that is our feeling right now. I think LeapFrog, which is an organization that is sponsored by employer groups and insurance companies, has created this survey, but they don't really seem to have a lot of knowledge of the ASC industry. And the survey really is very hospital-oriented, really. And when this op-ed article was published in the New Jersey newspaper, the New Jersey Association really took offense at what was stated. And their concern was that LeapFrog was implying that surgery centers are not responding, and therefore patients really don't have any information about the quality of care in ASCs. And that, of course, as we all know, is really not true. And so one of the other reasons that we discourage people from participating in the LeapFrog survey is it is very time consuming, and perhaps more importantly, its relevance and utility is quite questionable. There really is almost no value added to doing this. So again, as I said, I do encourage listeners to not waste their time. We have so many other avenues for quality reporting, one of which we just talked about. You know, obviously you have to participate in the Medicare Quality Reporting Program if you don't want to lose reimbursement. And there's a lot of great information that comes out of that program. Mm-hmm. We've talked about ASCquality.org in the past, which is a great resource for you to, you know, do benchmarking against other organizations. So there are a lot more reliable avenues for quality reporting and benchmarking. And as stated in the response from the New Jersey Association to that op-ed article, consumers seeking reliable information about ASCs have access to alternative and more useful sources, such as publicly available data provided by CMS. And the data that CMS collects not only encompasses crucial quality metrics, but also certifies an ASC's compliance with the stringent conditions aimed at safeguarding patient health and safety. Mm-hmm. I would love to talk to the people over at LeapFrog if they were ever interested in discussing this a little bit more. But we will provide a link to that article there. And you can also see the response that the New Jersey Association issued in response to it. And I did want to point out another point that was made in the response by the New Jersey Association. They said that the op-ed's attempt to provoke increased ASC participation in the LeapFrog survey in New Jersey, as evident from the article published in the New Jersey Spotlight News, overlooks these critical distinctions and fails to acknowledge existing avenues for assessing ASC quality. Rather than pressuring ASCs to conform to a survey ill-suited to our unique operational context, LeapFrog should engage in collaborative efforts to tailor their assessment tools to better address the specific needs and challenges faced by ASCs. So, you know, my knowledge of what's going on here, and certainly nobody has reached out to us here about the LeapFrog survey, is that if they had really reached out to organizations in the industry to develop a better survey, perhaps there would be more participation and perhaps it would be a better outcome. So, Sue, seems like we're always talking about medication safety, aren't we? So I know you saw an article in the Outpatient Surgery magazine.
In AORN's Outpatient Surgery magazine from March, they had a list of 10 medication deficiencies that were most often cited during surveys and inspections. And they also gave suggestions from pharmacy consultant Sheldon Sones on how to prevent these issues. And I'm just going to mention a few of them. So failure to document receipt of controlled drugs. And Sheldon Sones reminds centers that you must document on DEA Form 222 and the Controlled Substance Ordering System form when receiving Schedule II controlled drugs, and you should keep the records for 3 years or more if specified in your state regulations. And never store similar or same drugs of different concentrations next to each other without very clear separation and labeling. So if you keep different concentrations of a particular drug, just be very careful with that. Some issues that we've also talked about frequently are improper or no labeling of syringes, use of single-use medications for more than one patient, and expired medications not being separated for disposal or return. And they also mentioned poor medication security practice, and specifically the drawers of the anesthesia cart not being locked, which is something I think you've mentioned, John, that's kind of an easy catch for every surveyor. You know, if you want something to cite, go check that anesthesia drawer.
Yeah, and exactly. And there's so many great products out there right now that, that will be convenient to the anesthesiologist. I know a common comment is that it's just too much work to lock and unlock that thing with a key. Well, you know, you got a push button device is available, and just make sure you change the code, because Lori points out to me that many people don't change the code and it's just like 111 or whatever. So make sure that you use a code that's not easily determined.
And we wanted to talk about a CMS fact sheet on the Change Healthcare cyber attack and the option for accelerated payments to Part A providers and advanced payments to Part B suppliers.
So we're going to do a deep dive into the Change Healthcare cyber attack in our second segment here. But keep in mind, ambulatory surgery centers are Part B providers, and ASCs that have been impacted on the Medicare side by the cyber attack have some options available to them. And as I said, we'll talk more about the actual cyber attack in our focus segment, but we want to mention some of the issues here. So the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which CMS, recognizes the impact that the cyber attack on United Healthcare Group's subsidiary Change Healthcare and Optum in late February has had on the healthcare operations across the country. And on March 9th, 2024, CMS made available Change Healthcare Optum payment disruption accelerated payments to Part A providers and advance payments to Part B suppliers, which would be ambulatory surgery centers, that are experiencing claims disruptions as a result of the incident. CMS continues to monitor the incident and its level of disruption, and providers and suppliers are should continue to work with their payers for the latest updates on how to receive timely payments and any additional short-term funding programs that might be offered through other payers. CMS further encourages providers and suppliers to work with their liability insurers to determine whether coverage for this disruption is available. And again, Sue, we do talk about it in that in the interview in our second segment here. But you really need to make sure you have cybersecurity insurance now to avoid that.
Yeah.
We're going to provide a link to a lot of information on this, including eligibility requirements. So if you want more information on that, you know, feel free to look in our show notes here for that information. So I thought we would talk about some of our recent experiences. Let's start with HHHC's. HHHC's new 1095 Engage system is up and running. You know, we found that logging into the system is actually pretty easy, but they are still working out a number of kinks. The biggest issue appears to be right now doing applications or starting applications. If you are behind in submitting your application or about to submit an EOS, Early Options Survey application, you may wish to reach out to HHHC to identify ways to expedite your application. They are asking all applicants to fill out a spreadsheet right now with the information that is normally requested as part of the application. I'm going to be meeting with HHC during Ask a 2024. Mm-hmm. I'll be asking some of these questions. Maybe I'll even be able to record some of the responses on my portable recorder, and we'll be able to get back to you right away as to where we are in this. And HHC has also noted that the new application will require more information than has previously been requested in the old system. So be prepared for that. I think all this is going to be great for surveyors, Sue. You know, we'll have a lot more information going into the survey than we've had in the past. But, of course, it will be an inconvenience to those of you like you, Sue, you know, who have quite a number of years of experience in preparing these applications.
Well, even for you surveyors, so it's going to be a little bit of a learning curve with the new way that they're doing things.
Yeah, I do, you know, have patience with us poor surveyors. You know, we're getting trained as quickly as they can on the new system. We won't be using the new system right away because there are still quite a number of applications that are pending from V42. But as soon as they switch over, the surveyors are going to have a learning curve there. Mm-hmm. So we also want to know that one of the big changes with 1095 Engage is the annual attestation. At the present time, it appears that the system is generating emails that are informing centers that their attestation is due, but we've yet to be able to actually file an attestation or even be able to see the attestation. Again, this is likely due to the system not being fully up and functioning yet. And Sue, I went in this morning and looked at a couple of our clients that who had received emails saying that an attestation was due, and I couldn't find any way to actually file that attestation. So.
And is that providing any type of proof, or is it just kind of saying, "Yep, we're following along with what we said we would do," kind of a sign-off thing?
Correct. And to the best of my knowledge. So this is very similar to the experience that those of you who work with Joint Commission or ACHC that have to do an annual update to those organizations. So now HHC is going to be recording the same thing. If you've been in HHC for quite a number of years, you know, after you've passed your survey, filed your plan of correction, you really don't have any ongoing reporting requirements to HHC other than any major changes in your operation. So this will be a big change to those organizations. And again, all of these changes are fantastic. They're really going to make the HHC system, you know, much more robust. And integrating what currently exists, which is multiple systems, which have been developed over the years. So I'm very excited about what's going on with HHC's new 1095 Engage system, but there's a learning curve and there are going to be some challenges as they get it up and running.
And just for quality improvement and patient safety purposes, I think it is really good that just to keep it top of your mind over the years rather than, like you said, you know, we do see that there are some centers that kind of forget about it for 3 years, and then they try to get up and running. So this is going to kind of keep you on your toes, and in the end, might make it easier. You're not trying to catch up at the end of it. This is just the way you do business now.
I'm looking at Sue in the studio here as we're doing this, and behind this is Sue, one of our clients from a couple years ago, is doing exactly this.
No longer a client,
you know, they were no longer a client, and then they're now 6 months before their survey, even less than that,
than that.
they reached out to us and said, you know, can you help us get prepared for the survey? I said, sure. You know, where are you in the process?
Send us your information.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And it's no different than it was when we left them. So please do not be that center. Yeah. You know, quality improvement is an ongoing process, and you should be dealing with it every single month and not waiting for, you know, 6 months before your next survey. One of our listeners reached out to me this week and told me that they had received an immediate jeopardy during a deemed status survey. So the survey was on Thursday and Friday of last week, and I actually worked with her through the weekend. So I'm not going to indicate what accreditation organization was involved or the name of the organization, obviously, but I will note that they had a CMS team observing their survey. So, Sue, you and I have talked about this. The validation survey process has changed, and in the past, validation surveys would occur like within 30 days after a survey, where a team from the state would generally come in and do a survey again just to make sure that the accreditation organization had done a proper survey. That process changed in late 2023, and now CMS is sending a team out simultaneously with the accreditation organization.
I mean, in some ways it makes sense because they will see what you see. Things can change so much. So to try to judge the previous survey on what they saw a few weeks ahead of time. But boy, what a nightmare for the center and for the other surveyors, because not only is it going to be very crowded, they also, you know, anybody being watched is just going to really be overboard with you know, catching everything that they can.
Right. And I think that's exactly the issue. And I'm not sure, I don't know if that's what happened here. Another mm-hmm. thing that I want to point out is that the CMS team was not from the state in this situation. They were, they seemed to have been independent contractors that were hired, and they came from all different parts of the country. So anyway, what is really interesting was that they called an immediate jeopardy because the temperature and humidity was out of range, especially the humidity being around 70%. Now, one thing I should point out is a humidity of 70% should be something you are addressing. Yes. It should be a situation where you should be shutting down that operating room, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. And I've been talking to centers. We've been talking about it on our podcast. We've been talking about it during our educational programs. You need to take humidity issues seriously. And when they are outside of the range, you need to document what you are doing to fix that problem. And that if you can't fix the problem, you got to shut that room down.
Yeah. And definitely, you know, people don't take it as seriously as they should.
That's
They'll
right.
often document the temperature and humidity, but then just move on.
Right. Or I question whether they're really documenting the temperature and humidity.
If it never changes.
It never changes. Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, if I see, 50% humidity all the time, that makes me really wonder, just natural changes, in your room, opening the door, closing the room are going to change that. Mm-hmm. So there really are some issues here. So I really do feel like this is a wake-up call for centers here. And we have emphasized in the past how important it is to monitor and react to humidity that is outside of that acceptable range of 30 to 60%. And I've seen a number of centers that are using a range of 20 to 60% mm-hmm. for the humidity range. But I do need to note that that is only if you use a categorical waiver and present that waiver to the surveyors upon the commencement of the survey. And most importantly, that you can prove that all of the equipment and supplies in that room can be within that range. So you need to read your instructions for mm-hmm. use, your manufacturer's instructions. And you might be surprised at the number of equipment manufacturers and suppliers that require a range above 30%. Mm-hmm. So I did a survey in Pennsylvania about 3 weeks ago where indeed the humidity was, in this situation, below 30%. Mm-hmm. It was around 22%. And the organization said, well, it's acceptable because we have a range of 20 to 60%. I said, well, first of all, you didn't give me a categorical waiver when you mm-hmm. When I showed up. So unfortunately, that's not applicable. And then I said, pull the equipment manufacturer's instructions for use. And indeed, right in the specifications for that equipment, it stated that the operating range had to be between, I think it was 30 and 90%. I was surprised at the upper end of that.
Yeah.
But they were cited. I had to cite them for that. Mm-hmm. And I'm no expert on this by any means, but I do know mm-hmm. that humidities above 60% are dangerous from an infection control mm-hmm. standpoint because of the what it would do to the packaging. Mm-hmm. And humidities below 30% tend to be a fire hazard, especially mm-hmm. in high oxygen environments like we have in operating rooms.
And can dry out the packaging. And
right.
Just you don't know what it can do to the equipment. And it might be fine, but there's no way to know unless you have that on the instructions for use, and you're not likely to find that.
So a big takeaway here is please take temperature and humidity readings seriously. You need to be taking temperature and humidity readings anywhere in the clinical space where equipment and supplies are stored. So that would include storage rooms also. And make sure that your infection control coordinator is properly trained on the issues related to temperature and humidity and is part of the decision-making process when those temperatures and humidities fall outside of the acceptable ranges. They should be the ones that are making that decision. And I do know standing up to the doctors in this situation is often difficult. They're going to come back and say, oh, trust me, it's not going to affect patient care here. I'm going to do the operation anyway. But remember, this one center, which was forced to shut down, even though the rooms that they were going to continue using were not outside of the acceptable range. So that's mm-hmm. another point I wanted to make. I forgot to mention it earlier, Sue, is that the room that was affected by this mm-hmm. was not the room that they were going to be using for the surgery for the next couple of days. And as part of the plan of correction to mitigate the immediate jeopardy, they did say to the surveyors that they would not use that room, and the surveyor said that's not acceptable, that they were going to shut them down regardless. So again, a big takeaway here is the importance of monitoring your temperature and humidity and taking it seriously. So as we've mentioned, computer cybersecurity is certainly a major issue right now. And we all know that we've received emails recently or ongoing emails for quite a while that are attempts to access our systems or cybersecurity threats. And we are even now starting to get text messages. I'm getting at least one text message a day that are asking me to click on a link that are obviously going to be a problem. But the bad actors out there are finding more and more innovative ways of accessing your systems. The impact of a cybersecurity incident can literally endanger your ASC's existence. So to that end, we reached out to our sponsors at SIS and Paul Alcock to speak to this issue. And we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll have that interview with Paul Alcock.
Surgical Information Systems is a proud sponsor of the ASC podcast with John Gailey. Our award-winning software platform, SIS Complete, is the choice of over 1,000 ASCs. Why do so many surgery centers operate smart with SIS solutions and services? Because modern cloud-based software, with modules for inventory, scheduling, revenue cycle management, clinical documentation, patient communications, and analytics, all on one platform, streamlines workflows and delivers data, including detailed case costing, that helps centers run smoothly and stay focused on what matters most, patient care. Efficient, comprehensive, easy to use. That's smart. And it's all backed by an industry leader who has focused on surgical software for over 28 years. To learn how Surgical Information Systems ASC Software or Revenue Cycle Services team can help, call us at 800-866-0656 or visit us online at sisfirst.com.
I'm here with Paul Alcock, who is no stranger to the podcast. He's been with us a couple times, and today we thought we would talk about ASC preparedness for cybersecurity type issues. A little bit, I've greatly oversimplified that, of course, Paul, but welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on again.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John. It's good to be talking to you.
Paul, remind our audience who you are and what you do.
Sure. So as John mentioned, I'm Paul Alcock. I'm currently the Chief Information Security Officer over at Surgical Information Systems. So my role really is the strategic development and alignment of our information security program over at SIS. So everything from security operations, threat intelligence, governance, risk compliance, incident response, vendor third-party risk management, which we're going to talk a little bit about on the podcast today. All of that really kind of falls under my purview over here at SIS. So that's me.
Yeah. And you know, I think our listeners, I hope they're not getting tired of hearing us talk about cybersecurity. It seems like every, you know, couple of weeks we mention a cybersecurity issue in the news section. And of course, you and I have talked about it in the past, and we've talked it, you know, I mean, many times a year we end up having to talk about it in some way. And it's certainly not going away. I think some recent incidents, there was a Henry Schein incident a while ago that really kind of shut down some of the, distributor type relationships or caused some problems in the distributor relationships. And of course, the Change Healthcare issue, which came up recently, which is actually what prompted us to have this conversation, and that's not what we're going to focus on, but it is an interesting situation that reminds us that problems don't necessarily happen because of something that our organizations did, our ASCs did, that we can be greatly impacted by the activities of our vendors, of our insurance companies, you know, or affiliated organizations. So again, welcome. So why don't we start by just talking a little bit about Change Healthcare, and I think that's probably something that impacted quite a number, if not a majority of our centers in some way.
Yeah, I'd be hard pressed to imagine that it's certainly not impacting the business operations of a lot of our clients in the ASC market as a whole. And again, to your point, John, this really kind of has highlighted just the interdependence we have across the healthcare ecosystem and just how reliant we are on other businesses and companies for our business operations. And when you look at an organization as big as Change, which is obviously part of United Health and Optum, the impact that that's had on the U.S. healthcare system over the last few weeks. And for those who may be unaware, and everything that I'm going to talk about is publicly available. It's out on the internet and been disclosed by Change Healthcare and the Optum Group. But back early February, well, end of February, I'm sorry, about February 21st, it was reported that that Change Healthcare had been targeted by a threat actor group from the Russian-speaking countries of the world, let's say. And it ultimately, it was a ransomware attack. There has been some data exposure. We're not too sure what that is just yet. I know that Change and Optum are doing working their hardest to try and understand just what type of data has been exposed, but a significant amount of data is exposed. And then also the impact to the Change Healthcare health system. It really brought them crashing to a halt when this thing kicked off. And we're now, April 1st, and they're still not back up and running. We know that they're working hard to get there, but the impact has been widespread for weeks, coming to months now. So pretty significant across the space.
Right. And so what was the impact on your clients? I mean, you probably had some direct experience with some of the centers, you know, that rely upon your software, SIS. For those that don't know, that it's the SIS software that we're talking about here. What was the impact for those organizations that rely upon you to provide their billing and, you know, back office systems?
Yeah, so as far as our systems go, there's not really been any impact from an operational standpoint. SIS, Change Healthcare is more of a downstream vendor that maybe our clients would use for claims, eligibility, that type of thing. So we have noticed, obviously, the interconnections that we have been halted with the Change Healthcare environment. We no longer communicate directly from our application to Change Healthcare for these eligibility type requests, which is something that was in place prior to this incident. And obviously that's resulted in our clients having issues confirming insurance eligibility when they're processing claims and when they're trying to work through their back office operations. So we've had some communication with clients. We continually reach out. At least we were doing it daily. I think we're now at a couple of times a week just to advise on everything that we're learning that's being passed on from Change Healthcare and expectations on when we can have this service back up and running. But I think from a percentage standpoint across the SIS environments, we've got several applications, as I'm sure you're aware. The impact has been limited to a small section of those clients who are particularly using Change Healthcare. There are other clearinghouses out there that are not seeing any issue. And so we continue to see good efficiency there.
And as you mentioned, it is downstream from your software. So it is important for us to remind our listeners that your software was not connected at all, but that clients that rely on your software have noticed it because of a slowdown in payments too and verifying information, correct?
Exactly. That's it. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. And this has not been isolated to the ASCs, obviously. It has had a huge impact on the industry overall. I don't follow that. I don't know if you do. What other impacts have there been on the healthcare industry?
I think just the prescriptions, e-prescriptions was a big one that's been reported in the news as well. I know that initially when this kicked off, there were some real challenges in folks getting prescriptions because they weren't able to, the insurance wasn't able to process those prescriptions. People were having to pay out of pocket. And again, this is just what's being reported out there in the media. But the tech, it affected providers, billing abilities, hospital systems, pharmacies, practitioners. I saw a statistic, 94% of hospitals reported that the attack had financially impacted them in some way. So again, we can't underestimate the scope of this particular incident. And again, it just highlights that interconnectedness and the reliance that we have on some of our third-party vendors.
So that brings us to the ultimate question that we always have to address here is, what can our centers do? You know, what can ASC administrators and, you know, directors of nursing who are, you know, impacted very directly by these things do to protect themselves, you know, against, you know, obviously what happened with Change, against things that could happen internally as well as, you know, other, you know, even vendors out there, I mean, could impact your bottom line, which is actually what happened with the situation with Henry Schein.
Yeah. And this is a tricky one, right? But again, the reliance that we have on some of these larger vendors that, that operate within the healthcare system. We can be doing everything that we need to internally from a security standpoint, making sure that we have appropriate risk management. We're doing all the awareness and training. We're patching our systems. We have multi-factor authentication across the board. We're doing everything we need to do. We're checking all those boxes. But if we're totally and solely reliant on a particular vendor and that vendor is impacted in some way, then we're going to experience some downtime. We're going to experience some impact to our own business operations. So I think one of the things that we need to do, we need to apply appropriate and proper risk management strategies to our third-party vendor due diligence process. One thing that we always do internally is we fully understand the scope of any vendor before we jump into any relationship with them. We understand their security posture through evaluation of things like third-party attestations. Do they have a SOC 2, if that's appropriate? HITRUST certifications, ISO certifications, all these third-party attestations that can give us some confidence that, yes, they have the appropriate controls in place, but also our own security risk assessment, have the vendor complete that if appropriate again, really just to get an understanding of the services that we're being provided and how our data is being protected within their environment, how our data is going to move to and from this vendor environment. And also one of the things that we really should be focusing in on is not being so solely dependent on an individual vendor. Always have in the back of your mind, and in addition to confirming the security posture of any vendor, that there is a possibility in the future that that vendor may be compromised, you may be compromised, and having a plan in place to be able to address that, a business continuity, a disaster recovery plan. If this vendor were to go down, what would that mean for our business? How could we continue to function and limit the impact of these types of attacks should they be outside of our control? So it's really a multi-pronged approach. We use this term in cybersecurity defense in depth. We need to make sure that, yes, we have the appropriate controls in place. Our vendor has the appropriate controls in place. We understand the services being provided, but we're also prepared in the event that something were to happen that we can continue business operations, whether that's moving to paper, having a different vendor, or kind of diversifying our vendors, if you like, having multiple vendors that can complete the same functions for us. It really is going to be turned on the business function and I guess your budget at the end of the day.
We've been talking quite a bit recently on the podcast and our educational programs about risk assessments. And there's many different types of risk assessments in an ASC. Many of them have nothing to do with IT, but, you know, infection control risk assessment, NFPA 99 risk assessment, chemical risk assessment. And then we get into those things that kind of indirectly have an impact or directly have an impact, like a hazard vulnerability analysis, which is the Kaiser Permanente example is out there. That hazard vulnerability or disaster planning risk assessment, emergency preparedness risk assessment there should include cyber type issues and IT type issues. So I think one piece of advice that we might have for our listeners is to make sure that they look back at their HVA and take it really seriously. Look both internally and externally. So internally would be, you know, something in your own computer system that goes down, but externally would be, just as you mentioned, Paul, you know, what you're absolutely right. What would be the impact of losing your major vendors? And I would venture to say most of our listeners probably have not addressed that either in the HVA or in, in any other document. So I think that's a great idea. Just, and I'm just putting it in a context of regulatory context, you know, that we have this wonderful tool out there, but you need to think much more broadly than, you know, things like hurricanes and tornadoes and things like that. Something that's much more likely to happen, of course, is a cyber attack of some type.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned it at the start of when we kicked off the session this afternoon. It's not going away, right? We continue to see these cyber attacks impacting the healthcare space for whatever reason. I've talked in the past about why healthcare is so targeted, the value of PHI, legacy systems, budget restraints, lack of resources, that sort of thing. Whatever the reason behind it, adversaries are being very successful in targeting the healthcare space. When we look at what's going on with Change Healthcare, the reported payout was $22 million that these threat actors received for performing this type of attack. $22 million is no joke, and it's no surprise when you've got threat actor groups out there getting this type of money for performing these types of attacks, that we're going to continue to see it. So integrating cybersecurity into risk management processes is paramount. It is now a critical function of your business, whether we like it or not. Cybersecurity isn't going away. The technology we're using, the interconnections that we've talked about numerous times today, it's just going to grow. You start looking at leveraging AI and these types of tools. Technology is accelerating at such a rapid rate that we need to get in front of it, and we need to make sure that we're protecting our patient data and our business.
So you mentioned earlier the security risk assessment. Let's jump into that for a bit, because I am not finding, either as a surveyor or even working with some of our clients, that many organizations have done an IT security risk assessment. And now I know SIS obviously has a very sophisticated one that you have to do and that is certified, but ambulatory surgery centers should and could do this also. I mean, it's not necessarily cheap, but it's really something that has to be done and kept updated. It's not something that has to be done every single year, but it has to be updated anytime you've had major changes. Can you talk just a little bit about what a security risk assessment would look like?
Yeah, and they are subjective at the end of the day, right? So when we complete a security risk assessment, this is based off of what we believe and our views, our understanding of the business, our understanding when we're specifically talking about cyber threats, our understanding of the threat landscape, and what are the biggest risks to our business. So initially, the first thing we're going to need to do if we're going to perform any type of risk assessment is get a really good understanding of the business. What are we trying to protect? Where is our sensitive information? What does our environment, our networks look like? What kind of systems do we have? Get all this cataloged and inventoried, classify it. That's based on its importance to the business. If this server were to go down with this data, what would that mean to us? And that's always a good way to look at these things. If we were to lose this particular business function, or if we were to lose this internet connection, or our VPN were to go down, or this disk were to be corrupt, what would that mean to our business and our daily operations, and how could we recover from that? So once we've understand the business, once we understand the network and what it is that we're trying to protect, then we can start looking outward. Start using tools out there and resources. CIS is a member of the Health Information Sharing and Analysis Center. It's a nonprofit organization. It's a huge space for us to collaborate with other healthcare cybersecurity professionals to share information about what they're seeing out there, the membership fees. And I cannot recommend HISAC enough. It's been absolutely invaluable to myself and our security team and CIS as a whole in getting a really good understanding of what that threat landscape looks like. And when I talk about threat landscape, what I'm trying to do is understand what type of groups are likely to be targeting my organization. What are their motivations? How do they typically succeed? How are they successful? Do they take specific paths into the organizations that they've targeted in the past? And once I understand the tactics of these adversaries and how they're likely to target organizations like ours, then I can really focus my strategy on defending and identifying vulnerabilities, mitigating those vulnerabilities, and reducing the overall risk. That said, to perform a thorough risk assessment, it isn't for the faint of heart. It can be pretty complicated, particularly if you've not experienced in this area of the business in the past. So getting a third party, and CIS uses several third parties to perform risk assessments every year. We are HITRUST certified. We have SOC 2s. We have ISO 27001 certifications. We need to perform a HIPAA risk assessment. Our information security program aligns with the NIST cybersecurity framework. All of these different standards, controls, regulations, all are evaluated for risk across our business annually. So again, we use several third parties for that. It can be pretty expensive, but there are people out there, there are businesses out there that can help you just at least get started on performing a risk assessment, better understand what risks your business is facing.
And make sure that you're hiring a reputable firm that's got good credentials as well as good references there. This is not, I joke frequently when I talk about this subject nationally that we can't rely upon our high school student anymore to maintain our network. Now we need real professionals that are familiar with these cybersecurity type issues and the current marketplace, which brings me to another topic that I've been particularly passionate about lately, and that is the use of in-house servers versus, you know, cloud-based servers, because we've moved everything, you know, to cloud-based ourselves in our company, and encourage as many of our clients as possible to, you know, get rid of those in-house servers. What are your thoughts on that one?
I can definitely see it being a good fit. And it does alleviate, let's say, some of the responsibility in from a security standpoint, at least. Not all of it. Yes, you can leverage cloud services, Azure, GCP, AWS to host your servers and systems. And then depending on the type of service model that you're using, whether it's just the server itself, the physical infrastructure that you're leasing from these vendors, or you're actually you're down to just the operating system applications that you install. It really is going to depend on the type of service model, but ultimately the cloud provider is going to take some responsibility for securing that particular infrastructure. Now there's a cost associated with that as well, but when you weigh that against the maintenance and the licensing fees of having these systems on prem. Maybe it's a wash. It really is going to depend on your on what you're using these systems and services for. But you also have the benefit of availability, scalability, flexibility that comes with leveraging these cloud resources. So I think it's a good idea. I think it's we're seeing more and more organizations move into the cloud. Although on the same token, I have heard more and more organizations moving back from the cloud to on-prem. So it's one of those things. If it works for you, then go for it. There's definitely pros and cons to both, I would say.
And I do want to talk a little bit about cybersecurity insurance also. You know, one of the things that comes out of most of these security risk assessments is there's certain risks that you just can't mitigate that you're going to have to insure. And anybody that's looked at a security risk assessment, that's usually identified right in the conclusions that come out of it and identify. And what you do is you match up those risks that cannot be mitigated with, you know, your insurance policy to make sure that that covers each of those areas. Thoughts on that, Paul?
Yeah, cyber insurance is a really interesting end topic. And what we've seen over the last several years, and CIS obviously has a pretty comprehensive cyber insurance policy, we're actually going through renewal right now. And it's a pretty sophisticated process from a cybersecurity standpoint. We've definitely seen the questions that are coming across from these different insurance providers elevating in level of sophistication and comprehensiveness. They're asking questions that we'd never even dreamed of 5-6 years ago. Premiums are also increasing. And again, that's because the number of attacks is increasing, the number of payouts that these insurance providers are having to make because of these cyber attacks is escalating pretty rapidly. So yes, cyber insurance is definitely one of those things that you want to make sure you've got in your arsenal to, again, like you mentioned, to mitigate or transfer the risk from those that you can't mitigate internally to make sure that your business isn't going to drown if you go through one of these types of cyber events. But just be prepared when you are looking for cyber insurance. There are going to be some minimum controls that you need to have in place,
right,
to secure a premium. And the cost has definitely increased over, although I'll say this year, I believe we kind of plateaued a little bit, but the last several years, there's been significant increase in cyber insurance premiums, and it's understandable as to why.
Well, it'd be also interesting to see what the events that have occurred this year, whether that's going to have an impact on, you know, the premiums moving forward. Like you, I've seen the same thing. A lot of our clients having, you know, just filling out the application for cybersecurity is often quite daunting, especially if it's one of our poor nurse managers who, you know, doesn't understand the infrastructure that's behind all the technology that they have there. So this is, again, one of those areas you might even have to bring, you know, a computer expert in or bring your vendor in. Hopefully everybody has a vendor that they're working with to assist in maintaining that networking.
One more thing I just to mention on the cyber insurance, for those of you who are going through that process or looking to go through that process, and you're going through these security questionnaires, as John mentioned, they can be quite daunting and they can be pretty generic, and it can be hard to maybe decipher exactly what it is that they're looking for. Provide as much information as possible about your environment and your particular situation, rather than just check a box or say yes or say no. give some context around that, because it can really help clarify some of the muddier waters when it comes to IT infrastructure and the controls that you have in place. Maybe you don't have multi-factor authentication for a certain area of your network, of your environment. But just explain why you've chosen not to do that, or why you've implemented certain controls, or maybe not implemented certain controls is the better statement. And give some context as to why, because I think that's really going to help folks in securing those premiums at a lower rate.
Yeah, and I also wanted to go into just a little bit. As I visit surgery centers across the country, as I run into the different types of software that is out there to run the surgery center, both from basically management information systems, billing, scheduling, inventory management, accounting systems, I find a wide variety of them, and some of them are not systems that have been designed for ASCs even. Those are the ones I worry about the most. Now, of course, I'm speaking, to the guy that represents one of the major, vendors out there that's specifically, service ASCs. But I just want to remind people how important it is to have a product that is designed for ASCs that you can rely upon it, and using these large vendors. The other thing I'm finding is, people sometimes go with these smaller systems that may or may not have the level of protection that's built into the major providers out there, the major systems.
Yeah, and that's one of the selling points with what you talk about, moving servers to the cloud. But when it comes to moving your operations to the cloud and leveraging a platform like some of the SIS products that we host up in Azure, we have the resources, we have the dedicated security team, we have the technologies in place. We are evaluated, like I've mentioned, by multiple different third parties who specialize in this area to make sure that the environment that we are hosting and where we are storing patient data, the critical business information, has all of the controls that are needed to protect it. Now, there's always going to be risk, risk. You kind of touched on that, John, a little bit earlier. But when you're strapped for resources internally, maybe don't have the manpower or the expertise to secure your environment, leveraging those type of cloud resources where you know that there is a dedicated team responsible for securing that environment, that they have the funding and the budget to purchase the appropriate technologies, the more sophisticated technologies to protect that environment. I think that's one of the biggest selling points for me when it comes to do we host this stuff in our own environment, or do we start looking to a third-party SaaS product for our operations?
And of course, we've talked about the high level, the more difficult things to deal with, but there are some very basic stuff, very basic things that every surgery center needs to take seriously, like passwords, securing the workstations, being very careful about who has access to your organization, and removing users that have exited your organization. You want to just mention some of those basic things that we haven't even mentioned here, but are so basic that we sometimes forget how important they are.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised that just some of the fundamental cybersecurity controls can really limit 90% of the risk. It's not rocket science here when we talk about what we need to do to protect our environment. You mentioned passwords. Passwords, we want to make sure that they are at least 12 characters. You will see passwords is one of those things where the best practice around what constitutes good password management tends to fluctuate quite a bit year in, year out. We have kind of moved away from making these really crazy, long, complex passwords and having people change their passwords every 30 days. In more looking toward, let's start leveraging things like passphrases. Think of your favorite movie quote, your favorite song lyric, kind of adjust some of the characters in there, add some numbers, add some special characters. We don't need to change these passwords every 5 minutes. There's been plenty of research out there that has found when you do that, when you force your users to change their password every 30 days, that they start creating weak passwords, where they start storing them on sticky notes on their yeah, monitors and under the keyboard, and that's not secure. We don't want that. One of the things that we're trying to do as security is we want to educate our end users, give them the skills and the knowledge that they need to be effective and secure in their role. And we don't want to impede their operations. We don't want to be a hurdle for them to try and overcome. We want to work together to protect the business. So password management, let's make them at least 12 characters long. If we can, if we have the capability, you always want to make sure we've got multi-factor authentication turn on. That alone can greatly reduce your risk. I'm not saying that multi-factor stops every attack, because it doesn't, and we are starting to see attacks out there, more sophisticated ones that are able to bypass multi-factor authentication. We hear of this MFA fatigue. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, John, but because we have MFA so widespread in every application that we look to use, from Facebook to your banking app, everyone's using multi-factor authentication, that people really don't pay attention to those notifications anymore. Yeah. You may receive a notification on your phone for a service you're not even logged into, but we see people just accepting those because they're so used to seeing it. And now you've just given the bad guy access to your application. So MFA at the right time, in the right place, make sure we've got that turned on. Make sure that we're only assigning permissions, and we're very strategic about who has access to what in our environment, particularly when it comes to patient records. We need to make sure that we're getting our systems updated. If you're using Microsoft, the second Tuesday of every month, Microsoft is going to release updates for your laptops, desktop, servers. Let's make sure that we're getting those installed. That's going to mitigate a lot of vulnerabilities. In addition to your operating system, third-party applications, they also need to be patched. Your Google Chrome, your Adobe PDF viewer, all those applications need to be updated as well. And awareness and training is a big one. I kind of touched on it briefly a few moments ago, but we need to make sure that our users, the employees on the front line, our administrators, even our physicians, everybody in the center has been trained on what to look for, particularly in phishing emails, how to securely navigate the web, and most importantly, what do we do when we do see something? Who do we reach out to? Who do we notify? And what steps do we need to take to mitigate these risks? So that's just some basic things, but you'd be surprised at how much good that can do and how that can greatly reduce your risk just by implementing some of the basic controls that really don't cost anything.
And lastly, let's kind of talk about mobile devices too, because that's another area that there's quite a bit of threat and risk also.
Yeah, so I mean, we saw since COVID-19, a lot of organizations were forced pretty quickly to move to remote work. So we've got laptops being used to connect into ASC networks, corporate networks from remote locations. We've been using cell phones for a while now to access corporate resources. I think a lot of people have their corporate email on their cell phone. We need to make sure that we've got an appropriate mobile device management solution in place. I think it's very expensive for organizations to purchase dedicated phones for employees. And so we tend to be a little more flexible about using your own device, your personal device, to be able to access corporate email. But there are plenty of tools out there and technologies that can segment that corporate data, that business data, from the personal applications that maybe you have on your phone. So one of the things that we use at SIS is Microsoft's Intune. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, John, but this mobile device management platform allows us to, yes, you can download Outlook, you can download Word, but you can't copy any of the data from your corporate Outlook into any of your personal applications. If a device was lost for any reason, we have the ability to go in and remote wipe just the corporate data only, that sort of thing. I mean, I could go on for hours talking about the controls that we can put in place with this. But the important thing is that we have visibility, or the ability, I should say, to control and segment our sensitive data on these personal devices without impacting the privacy of the individual who owns that device. So mobile device management, mobile security is really important. And then obviously with our laptops and desktops and everybody working remote from home, we need to make sure that we've got endpoint protection technologies deployed to those tools too. So your EDR, antivirus, that sort of thing, some kind of remote management solution. So your IT teams can get into these devices if they need to, but Yeah, it's since COVID, it's definitely taken off, and a lot of organizations, like I mentioned, they were forced to go into this remote situation, and it took a while to get caught up, but I think we're in pretty good shape right now.
Yeah, make sure you know all the products out there that are connecting into your system, as you indicated. Well, Paul, as always, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. It's good to speak to you again.
Same here.
In this segment, we provide an update on upcoming topics for the podcast, our upcoming virtual conferences, and upcoming speaking engagements for John and his staff and other events in the ASC industry.
And of course, ASCA 2024 is going to be at the Gaylord Palms mm-hmm. Resort and Convention Center in Orlando, Florida, April 17th through the 20th. I'll be heading down in a few minutes after the recording's done here, meeting up with people. If you see me around, make sure you say hi and that you like our podcast. Or if you don't like it, let me know also. We love getting feedback. And if you'd like to be on the podcast, reach out. Send me an email at info@ascpodcast.com with your telephone number, and I'll add you to our, assuming that we don't get 1,000 people signing up, we'll add you to our text message link, and you'll know when and where we're meeting up to record that podcast.
And the Arizona Ambulatory Surgery Center Association's conference is April 27th and 28th in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Westin Kierland Resort.
And the Ambulatory Surgery Center Director of Nursing and Nursing Leader Boot Camp will be May 28th through the 31st, 2024. It is a virtual boot camp. Mm-hmm. And for more information, go to asc-central.com. And there's a lot more to the boot camp than just that four-day conference, including weekly drop-in sessions that are optional, but I'm sure people will find that very valuable.
And the Gulf States Conference is June 11th through the 13th, 2024 in Biloxi, Mississippi, at the Beau Rivage Resort and Casino.
And the Ambulatory Surgery Center Administrators Boot Camp is going to be July 16th through the 19th, 2024, and again, presented virtually. And for more information about that, go to asc-central.com.
And Becker's Spine Orthopedic and Pain Management-Driven ASC Conference is June 19th through the 22nd in Chicago at the Swiss Hotel.
And the Florida Society of Ambulatory Surgical Centers annual conference and trade show is July 17th through the 19th in Orlando, Florida at the Signia by Hilton, Orlando, Bonnet Creek.
The Texas Ambulatory Surgery Center Society's annual conference is July 24th through the 26th in Galveston, Texas, at the San Luis Resort, Spa, and Conference Center.
The Georgia Society of ASCs and the South Carolina ASC Association's joint semiannual conference and trade show is going to be August 15th through the 16th, 2024, in Hilton Head, South Carolina, at the Marriott Hilton Head Resort and Spa.
The California Ambulatory Surgery Association's annual conference is September 4th through 6th in Anaheim, California at the Anaheim Marriott.
The Tennessee Ambulatory Surgery Center Association annual conference is September 12th through 13th, 2024 in Chattanooga, Tennessee at the Chattanoogan.
The Becker's ASC 30th annual meeting, the Business and Operations of ASCs, is October 30th through November 2nd in Chicago, Illinois, at the Hyatt Regency.
I'm laughing. I just saw that it said the 30th annual. I was at the first conference in Chicago with Scott Becker. Great conference, and I know we don't always remember to mention it, but definitely make sure you sign up for those two conferences. And mm-hmm. on-demand versions of the ASC Director of Nursing and the ASC Administrators Bootcamp and our Business Office Managers Bootcamp are available on our website at asc-central.com. And we do want to remind everyone to become a patron member of the podcast. The patron member program, which is available at asc-central.com, is an exclusive membership website that provides a one-stop ASC regulatory and accreditation, compliance, operations, and financial management resource for business administrators, nurse managers, and business office managers. And in addition to our regular, usually weekly drop-in Zoom sessions on Saturday mornings with other patron members and the staff of the podcast, there are additional patron resources available, which include some of our virtual conferences, like the Credentialing Conference and the Conditions for Coverage Conference, example policies and procedures, example forms, and our famous fire and disaster drill kits. Membership helps defray the cost of producing the podcast, including research staff, travel costs to conferences, equipment costs, and production costs. For more information, please visit asc-central.com.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. If you found this episode informative, we encourage you to share it with your friends and colleagues in the ASC industry. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you'll never miss an episode. We would love any feedback about our episodes or ideas for future episodes by sending us an email at comments@ascpodcast.com.
And we'd like to give a special thank you to our great team here who make this podcast possible. Our sound editor is Susan Cronkite, our executive producer, John Gailey, and our dedicated research team of Susan Cronkite, Jenna Alvarez, Judy D'Ambrosio, Mike D'Ambrosio, Alex Borneman, Zach Kalritis, Jim Masters, Amy Cronkite, Lori Rodericks, Kathy Fodi, Donna Macchio, Christina Norman. And we certainly couldn't do it without them.
Our music is provided by Media Sushi and Mike Noah, and the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is hosted on Podbean and is available on all major podcast platforms.
Thanks for listening, and hopefully we'll see you at ASCA 2024.
This episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is sponsored by Surgical Information Systems, SIS. SIS's mission is to deliver solutions and services that help surgery providers, regardless of care setting, improve their organization so they can deliver the highest level of care to their patients. For more information, go to sisfirst.com. This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute, legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development. All rights are reserved. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.